From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, a special series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Coming Home.
So let me say this as plainly as I can. By August 31st, 2010, our combat mission in Iraq will end.
President Obama plans to bring home some 150,000 troops. But what are they coming home to? Their divorce rate is triple the national average. Alcoholism, four times the average. PTSD, unemployment, suicide. And a nation weary of the war they fought. This hour, coming home from Iraq.
Suicides on Fort Campbell have to stop now. This is not the reputation of the legendary Screaming Eagles of the 101st Airborne Division.
Sitting in the lobby is really where I received my therapy or the most healing from the VA was in that lobby, because as I was waiting for my appointment, I was surrounded by these veterans from Vietnam, even a few from World War II.
When you look back at the history of our country, there is no previous generation from whom we have asked so much, placed so much on their shoulders on behalf of so many for so long.
He said, "This is the worst part." And I kind of looked at him, and he's like, "This is the worst part, coming home." And he looks around the bar, and he goes, "No one here gets it. No one here will understand." And, you know, he's kind of right. I never forgot that. You know, the worst part, you know, is kind of coming home.
But not everyone who went to Iraq is coming home. Some 4,300 Americans have died in Iraq since the war began. Major Steve Beck knows this only too well. He is a Marine Casualty Notification Officer. His mission is the unthinkable. He knocks on the door of the next of kin of a fallen Marine. Journalist Jim Sheeler wrote a book about Major Beck and the families torn apart by his news. It's called Final Salute. Sheeler told Ann Strangchamps that a Marine family's worst fear is seeing Major Beck on their porch.
They know that if they see the uniformed service members on their front porch, it means the worst has happened. He says they always know. They automatically know. I've talked to mothers who've locked the door as soon as they've seen the men on the steps, and they refuse to let them in. They say that they felt at the time that if they could just prevent the message from getting to them, that it wouldn't happen, and they could delay it. But Major Beck says that they always have to. They have to always end up opening the door.
What does he say? Does he have a format?
There's a script that they're taught to memorize, but Major Beck says that he always adds a little of his own personality to it, depending on the situation, tries to gauge what the family might need at that point, what they might need to hear, that will go along with the pre-written script. And I think that's kind of what's special about him and a lot of the casualty officers. I think there are a lot of notification officers who are like Major Beck in different ways, because I believe they all bring their own personal histories to that moment. In a lot of ways, he feels that his whole life leads up to that moment. The deaths that he's seen, the people he's taken care of throughout his life, and just the ways he's been taught to care, it all culminates in that moment when that widow or mother or father opens the door and he has to find the words.
What a devastating job.
It is. It is. And it takes the toll on them as well. I mean, it has to. He says that, you know, if you don't feel it, then there's definitely something wrong. And he said that he tries to remain composed throughout the whole notification process. And oftentimes he would end up crying in the dark on the way home.
And what do the family members remember?
Usually, it's that moment of seeing him is what they remember more than the actual message. And Major Beck will be the first one to say this, that him standing on the porch is the message in so many ways, that it doesn't matter what the Defense Department has told him to say. They know.
You write about several such visits that he makes, and I wondered if you could describe one of them to us. I mean, there's one, for instance, when he went to tell Second Lieutenant Jim Cathy's family.
Sure. Catherine Cathy was a pregnant 23-year-old whose husband had left not long before Major Beck showed up on her door. And she was actually taking a nap when he came to her parents' house, actually, where she was. And so her father-in-law answered the door, and he said, "Oh, no." And her mother saw him, and then she just started crying incessantly, waking Catherine up. And as he came to the door, the father-in-law came to get Catherine. She wondered what was wrong with her mother. And as soon as she saw Major Beck standing in the doorway, she knew what had happened. She was just supposed to go the next day to find out if their baby was going to be a boy or a girl. And she screamed and wouldn't look at the notification officers. She went and took a bath, a long bath. And then she came out and they waited. And when she came out, they told her what they had to.
These are such devastating, difficult stories. And I think what's hard is they're so invisible. I mean, even when you read in the newspapers, you know, that perhaps a young man in your community has been killed, you don't think about this moment, about how the family learned.
Right. And it's so touching and so many times and so powerful. You know, when you think, as soon as somebody dies in Iraq or in Afghanistan, I mean, what they do first is they shut down all communication so that nobody finds out before the next of kin. They actually have a communications blackout. So
nobody emails anybody who might have
exactly
known.
Exactly. As Major Beck says, in many cases, they're erasing the electron to try and get to the family as soon as possible to let them know in person so that they don't find out from an email or a phone call.
Does Major Beck do anything himself to prepare for making that knock at the door?
A lot of times he said he would sit in the car beforehand and look out at the house. I mean, he would almost look at the situation as if he's going into battle, a different kind of battle. It's that he had to be ready for whatever possibilities might happen. You know, if someone's screaming, if they're not, if they're quiet, if they don't want him to talk to him. He's had some of his Marines who've actually been slapped by mothers. You know, you have to prepare for all of that, he says. And then he said, you just have to force yourself to walk up there and deliver the message.
It reminds me of something you quoted Major Beck saying about that moment on the doorstep. He said, when he looks in the eyes of the family members, he says, they're falling, either literally or figuratively, and you have to catch them. In this business, I can't save his life. All I can do is catch the family while they're falling. What is that catching the family mean? I mean, it's about more than just giving them the first news that their son has been killed.
Right. That first visit is definitely not the end. It's just the beginning. He made a point of making sure that everything that they needed would be taken care of. That if they needed a special escort to bring their loved one home, he would find a way to make sure that Marine would be able to do that duty. For a long time, in some cases, the personal effects, the things that the guys had in Iraq, would just arrive a couple of weeks to a couple months later and just arrive on the family's doorstep. And Major Beck refused to allow that to happen. He personally delivered all of those effects to the family and sat with them in many cases as they went through the letters and the uniforms and the wallets of their sons and husbands. And in many cases, he was that shoulder that they cried on. And I don't know how many times I saw that shoulder of his uniform stained dark with the family's tears.
It's part of knowing what the real price of war is.
Exactly, and the sacrifice of the families. I think that's something also that people just, I as a civilian, I had no idea of the sacrifice of these families, especially for these guys who are going over three or four times, you know, to be there in the living rooms and talking to them about, you know, how it just doesn't end. And for the families, it never will end. I just spoke with one of the widows recently, and it had been 5 years since her husband was killed, and she said, you know, actually this anniversary is worse than any of the others. And I asked why, and she said, I just realized that 5 years means that I've officially known Jesse dead longer than I knew him alive. I mean, even Melissa Givens, that widow, they continue to celebrate his birthday. And he has two little boys, one little boy that never got to see him. And so on his birthday, they'll blow up helium balloons and write messages to them on the helium balloons and then go outside and release the balloons. And I asked what they were doing, and Dakota, his younger son, said, well, we're sending the balloons to heaven. The stories, they do never end. I mean, even Dakota, when Melissa told Dakota that his dad was dead, he said, well, where is he? And she said, well, he's in heaven. And he said, well, am I going to be there? And she said, yeah, but it's going to be a long time from now. And he asked his mom, well, when I get to heaven, can I still be 5 years old so dad can put me on his shoulders in the park?
Thank you so much for sharing these stories with us.
I think it's crucial that people know these stories because they really need to know what these families are doing for them.
Jim Sheeler, speaking with Ann Strangechamps. His book is called Final Salute. On January 31, 2004, Sergeant John McCary wrote an email to his family in North Carolina about the brutal nature of the insurgency and the random violence claiming the lives of his fellow soldiers. Here's Iraq War veteran Sergeant McCary reading that email.
Dear all, we are dying. Not in some philosophical or chronological, the end comes for all of us sooner or later sense. Just dying. Sure, it's an occupational hazard, and yeah, you can get killed walking down the street in any town USA, but not like this. Not car bombs that leave craters in the road. Not jeering crowds that celebrate your destruction. It's never been a fair fight, and we haven't always played nice, but not like this. No one leaves the gate looking to kill or looking to die. No one wakes up in the morning and says, I sure hope blowing up a whole group of Iraqis goes well today. That's for suckers and cowards. People afraid to delve into the melee and fight it out, to sort it out like soldiers. They've killed my friends. And not in some heroic fight to defend sovereign territory, not on some suicide mission to extract a prisoner or save a family in distress, just driving downtown to a meeting, just going to work. What do you say to your men after you've scraped up the scalps of an entire Iraqi family off the road, right next to the shattered bodies of your soldiers, held together only by their shoelaces, body armor, or helmets? We're fighting the good fight. I don't think so. We're just fighting. And now we're dying. When you've held a conversation with a man, briefed him on his mission, his objective, and reminded him of the potential consequences during the actioning of it, only to hear he never returned and did not die gracefully, though blessedly quickly, prayerfully, painlessly, you do not breathe the same ever after. Breath is sweet. Sleep is sweeter. Friends are priceless. And you cry. There's no point, no gain, no benefit, but you're human, and you must mourn. It is also now undeniable, irrevocable, that you will see your mission through. You will strive every day. You will live though you're not ever again sure why. Ideals are so far, far away from the burnt stink of charred metal. We must see it through to the end. They have seen every instant, every mission, every chore, every day through, not to its end, but to theirs. They died standing with their friends, doing their jobs, fulfilling some far-flung, nearly non-existent notion called duty. They died because their friends could have died just as easily, and knowing that, they would never shirk their duties, never call in sick, never give in to fear, never let down. Their lives are lost, whether as a gift laid down at the feet of their friends or a pointless discard of precious life. I doubt I'll ever know. I'm okay, Mom. I'm just a little shaken, a little sad. I know this isn't any divine mission. No God, Allah, Jesus, Buddha, or other divinity ever decreed, go get your body ripped to shreds, it's for the better. This is man's doing. This is man's war, and war it is. It is not fair, nor right, nor simple, nor is it over. I don't care about bloodlust, justice, or revenge, but we will not give up. We cannot. Our lives are forever tied to those lost, and we cannot leave them now as we might have were they still living. We have so little time to mourn, to breathe, to laugh, to remember, to forget. Every day awaits us, impatient, impending. So now we rise, shunning tears, biting back trembling lips, and stifling sobs of grief. And we walk, shoulder to shoulder, to the call of duty, in tribute to the fallen.
Sergeant John McCary served in Iraq with the U.S. Army's 1st Infantry Division at Al Anbar Province. For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Coming Home, is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
My name is Captain Dan Hansen. I was deployed with the 724 Engineer Battalion, and I was the heavy equipment platoon leader in the engineering company.
Hi, I'm Josephine Jerome. I was a lieutenant when I deployed with the 229th Engineer Company out of Prairie du Chien and served as a platoon leader for a heavy equipment platoon.
My name is James Sandomirsky. I was a brigade intelligence officer with the 264th Engineer Group for OIF-2.
I'm Lieutenant Shannon Kilcoyne, and I deployed with the 264th Engineer Group of Chippewa Falls. And as I was deployed, I was a platoon leader for a combat heavy engineer battalion.
Hi, my name is Staff Sergeant Brian Worthing. I was a convoy escort squad leader with the 1158th Trans Company. First thing that I missed about being over there was the fact that over here, cars don't get out of my way. Over there, everyone moved for me.
Anything that I could miss over there is back home with me, and that's pretty cool.
Absolutely nothing. I brought everything with me, and it was here waiting for me.
I miss the everyday gratefulness for my life.
I think I miss the consideration from person to person. You know, we have a hard time back here getting along in an office space, and yet we could sleep that many people in one area and work together day in and day out and still get along.
After being home for just about a year now, I really miss the simplicity of life in a combat zone. Ultimately, our mission over there was simple. Get up in the morning, get your job done, no matter what it entailed, and get home safely.
The things I missed were fairly simple. The weather was warm, ammo was free, and I was finally doing the work that I'd spent over 14 years as a National Guardsman training to do.
I felt like I was doing something globally and historically important, and I've never had a greater sense of purpose in my life.
Many returning Iraq War veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder suffer alone. They don't seek treatment. They don't deal with it. They don't talk about it. Kyle Houseman Stokes was no different, but when he tried going to college, he struggled with PTSD. So he got help. He also picked up his camera and made a film about it. The film is called Now, After.
Initially, I had intended it to be nothing more than to give people a background on what soldiers go through post-deployment and struggling with PTSD. Actually evolved unbeknownst to me into this autobiographical, very therapeutic and cathartic experience. I guess it's just a story about a young veteran that's struggling in his new life as a college student, trying to kind of forget some of the demons from his past and serving in a combat zone in Iraq. Long story short, he kind of finds some solace, and he finds some of that camaraderie that he was missing from the military at a local VA and through kind of his brothers in arms from the war past. And I don't know, it was just a really positive experience for me, and it's actually 100%, like I said, autobiographical and true, that everything that is depicted in the film is something that happened to me almost exactly literally, all the way down to, when I was that young troubled veteran at the VA for the first time. There was some veterans who kind of took me aside and shook me by the scruff of the neck, not almost kind of brought me back down to earth. Yeah. And it was just something so positive, I felt it was important to maybe share.
In fact, that's the very powerful ending to this short film. And his decision to go there is entirely his. But once he's there, well, maybe you could describe what happens when he walks in.
What happens in the film, and this is exactly what happened to me in real life, is I guess maybe I'll tell it from first-person point of view. I went to the VA, and I still had a pretty big chip on my shoulder, I guess, like a lot of people who do suffer from, various levels of PTSD, especially being military and infantry and, combat-hardened. It's, getting help, it is not something that we do. It's not something we're trained to do. Our solution to everything in the infantry, at least, is, drink water and drive on. That fixes everything. So what happens in the film and what happened to me is I walked in still very hesitant and cynical to the whole process. But I guess I was kind of at that point where, I was willing to kind of try anything. And sitting in the lobby is really where I received my therapy, or the most healing from the VA was in that lobby. Because as I was waiting for my appointment, I was surrounded by these veterans from Vietnam, even a few from World War II, who knew why I was there. Obviously, it's a VA, but, I had the ACU, the assault pack, and they knew where I had been. I was even still wearing the Iraq T-shirt, and I think they maybe saw a lot of themselves in me.
What would you do if I sang out of tune? Would you stand up and walk out on? Lend me your ears and I'll sing you a song. I will try not to sing out of key. Yeah. Oh, baby, how do you do?
In the film, they get up and come over and sit down next to you.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody talks. They just make it clear that they understand.
Right. And again, that's, one of the most powerful things is, the things that aren't said, the subtext, as you will, of the situation. That's exactly what happened. There wasn't a single word exchanged. I think, I don't know if we're still trying to be tough and not talk about it, but, just the glance or, really these guys, that's what I literally felt like they shook me. You know, they like I said before, like they grabbed me by the scruff of the neck, and these are the only people. Had it been one of my classmates, a professor or a civilian doctor, you know, I just wouldn't be okay with that. Yeah, I would resist it. I'd say, you don't understand. You don't get me. You know, who the hell are you? But these guys, I mean, they're, how could I resist? They they've seen and tasted combat, I'm sure, twice as much as I ever had in those wars. And they're really my mentors in this healing process. So it was exactly what I needed.
That's the positive side of this, that this PTSD, even with the acceptance you found in the VA, PTSD isn't something that goes away, is it?
No, it doesn't. But I think taking that first step to get into the VA was the hardest but most beneficial one that I made. Since then and since making that film, I guess I didn't realize it until my mother pointed it out, but filmmaking for me has been the most, you know, cathartic and therapeutic way to deal with PTSD. You know, that was never written in a manual. Nobody ever told me, you know, if you're struggling from PTSD, you should take it out through some kind of art or, you know, medium like filmmaking. But no, it really doesn't go away. But I guess my intention with the film is I had an extremely positive experience at the VA, and, you know, I've been getting better ever since. And if I can depict that in the film and communicate with soldiers out there, you speaking their language because I am one of them, and they're able to, you know, infer some kind of meaning or message from the film and then take that first step to get into the VA, I think it's really, I don't want to say it's all taken care of, but it's a lot more downhill, you know, from that point on.
Staff Sergeant Kyle Houseman Stokes served as a convoy commander in Iraq, as a member of the 1st Battalion, 160th Infantry Regiment. His film is called Now After. Stokes is currently a film student at USC. Coming up, we talk with more veterans about coming home from Iraq.
You get out of the military and there's no, like, you know, from my experience, the only contact you get from them is to get you to re-enlist or go over there. I mean, there's, you know, they don't really do anything other than that for returning veterans that I've seen.
For To the Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Jim Fleming. This hour, Coming Home, is part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Now, I know that I don't need to give this speech to 99% of you, but there's probably about a half a percent of you that have had thoughts of harming yourself, and there's probably another half a percent of you that know soldiers who have thought that. But it doesn't matter, because we're all one team, and we're all in this together. So I'm going to give you the bottom line up front. If you don't remember anything else I say in the next 5 or 10 minutes, remember this. Suicidal behavior in the 101st and on Fort Campbell is bad. It's bad for soldiers, it's bad for families, bad for your units, bad for this division and our army and our country, and it's got to stop now. Suicides on Fort Campbell have to stop now. This is not the reputation of the legendary Screaming Eagles of the 101st Airborne Division. Who?
That's the commanding officer of Fort Campbell, home of the Army's 101st Airborne Division. In May of 2009, the base did an extraordinary thing. It shut down for 3 days following a rash of 11 suicides. And it's not just Fort Campbell. Suicide in the military has skyrocketed since the war in Iraq started. So have divorce rates, triple the national average. Alcoholism for Marines and soldiers, 4 times the national rate. And according to a recent RAND Corporation study, 1 in 5 service members, at least 300,000 people, suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Brigadier General Lori Sutton knows these numbers all too well. She's the military's top-ranking psychiatrist and the director of the Pentagon's Centers for Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury. Steve Paulson asked General Sutton about the surprising decision to close the Army base at Fort Campbell.
It's not at all unusual when there is an extreme incident or event or concern, whether it be an accident, for a commander to call for a safety stand down, or in this case, with the concern of suicide. So you're right, it was certainly a very strong action that spoke loudly about the commander at Fort Campbell's absolute concern with understanding this issue, getting the message out to his troops and their family members that they are not alone, that getting help is an act of courage and strength, and they will become stronger as a result to take that step.
Now, obviously, these issues are not just for those at Fort Campbell. Reentry has proven difficult for many returning troops. Suicide in the military has skyrocketed since the war in Iraq. So have divorce rates. I think the rates are something like triple the national average for people in the military. Alcoholism for Marines and soldiers is 4 times the national rate, according to some studies I've seen. What do you do with these kinds of problems? How do you get help?
Well, that's exactly why we are partnering, you know, with my organization, the Defense Centers of Excellence, which was established about, almost 2 years ago now. We were established as a result of the concerted attention following the Walter Reed tragedy. You know, there were a number of national task forces, commissions, great Americans who stood up to help the Department of Defense identify what needs to be done to improve things. And so one of the common recommendations was, DOD, what you need to do is establish a central open front door, if you will, which would be an integrative place to identify best practices, to validate evidence-based care, and to be able to reach across the continuum of resilience, recovery, and reintegration for our troops. So that's what my team has been dedicated to doing in partnership with the VA, as well as the rest of government, as well as communities around the country and throughout the world.
So you're saying that people high up in the military recognized that something was not working, that these returning troops, many of them, were not really being cared for. Something had to change to help them.
Yes. Think of it like this. You know, the early phases of this conflict, we had really devoted just enormous time and energy and attention to saving the lives of troops on the battlefield. And nothing's short of revolutionary in terms of the trauma care, which, you know, saves the life of a young troop at the point of injury with those great medics and corpsmen who have the life-saving training and resuscitation techniques, the ability to stop the hemorrhage, as well as to be able to transport them very rapidly to the combat support hospital. And this has resulted in the lowest died of wounds rate in the history of recorded warfare. Now, what we also learned, and what was certainly demonstrated with the Walter Reed tragedy, is that there was an enormous rehabilitation component to the care of these complex injuries. And we had not organized to provide that kind of rehabilitation. And so Walter Reed really became a blessing in disguise. I mean, we would have done anything certainly to prevent, would have wanted to do anything to prevent that level of tragedy. But what it did was it exposed the fact that as a department working with the Veterans Administration, we needed to retool our resources. We needed to revamp our disability evaluation system, which had not been updated since, I think, World War II. And we needed to work closely with families, with treatment programs around the country, and with leading scientists so that we could really provide the best clinical and rehabilitation care for our troops, as well as we could identify the knowledge gaps and invest in the science to answer those gaps.
Yeah. Well, let me take an example of, let's say a Marine has just come back home, returning from Iraq, and feels he or she might be suffering from post-traumatic stress. How does this person find help?
Great question. First of all, We have embedded mental health deployers who go out with the units. So that would be the first stop, is to check in with unit resources. And of course, the first level unit resource is going to be that young Marine sergeant. We also have chaplains who are available. We also have a screening program, which has developed considerably over the last couple of years of this conflict, so that Marines, as well as soldiers, sailors, and airmen, they're screened to check in with them before they deploy. Then while they are deployed, there's support available in theater. When they come back from deployment, they're screened again. Now, of course, we know that many of our troops will tell you, if all that stands between them and their 30 days of leave with their family, you know, they're not going to say anything that would risk keeping them back. And so we know it's important to not only check in immediately after deployment and to provide that support then, and we do have a number of folks who do come forward at that point for both physical as well as psychological and spiritual injuries, but then we also have a post-redeployment assessment between the 3 and 6 month mark following redeployment.
There's also a huge stigma in the military about admitting that you have post-traumatic stress. The various studies have shown that there are far fewer people who acknowledge this or who get treated than actually have it. And it would seem like there's a serious disconnect there.
Well, and this is exactly one of our concerns, because we know that we will continue to improve our ability to build resilience, to maximize recovery, to promote reintegration. But if along the way we fail to support our senior leaders in transforming the culture to one which recognizes that it's no more important to get help for a physical injury than it is for a psychological or a spiritual injury. This is our biggest challenge right now, and it's one of the reasons why we have recently introduced the Real Warriors campaign. In May of this year, we launched what will be a 3 to 5 year effort. This is a national public health education campaign that is designed to eliminate stigma. How will it do that? Well, by harnessing the power of real warriors telling their stories. I would invite you to take a look and check out Sergeant Josh Hopper, a young Marine sergeant who got help for PTSD following his second deployment, and he's now with Special Operations, and as his commander said, he's a stronger and more trusted agent now than he was even before his difficulties.
I'm Sergeant Josh Hopper, United States Marine Corps.
He did 2 tours in Iraq, fired thousands of rounds, saw lots of casualties, IEDs. The person he was before those deployments and when he came back, he was a different man.
He was really distant. Mood swings was a big thing. Drinking a lot. We fought constantly.
I couldn't sleep. All I think about is these negative thoughts. I just walked up to my CO saying, "Sir, I've had all I can take. I need some help."
The CO actually personally picked up the phone and lined up inpatient treatment.
It seemed like from that day on, when I would go to get treatment, you know, go to my classes, things like that, things started getting better.
Returning to full health and clearances and everything else, I actually respect him and trust him more now because of the fact that he had a problem, he had an issue, he brought it to me. Together we figured it out, we fixed it, and he's as good or better Marine now and in the future.
It takes real strength to swallow your pride and to say, "I need help," and to go actually get the help.
When you look back at the history of our country, there is no previous generation from whom we have asked so much, placed so much on their shoulders on behalf of so many for so long. And so to understand that no matter what we do in positions like mine and leadership around the military, the government, and at all levels of our communities across the nation, there's nothing we can do that's going to ever fully match the depth and level of their sacrifice. But everything we do has to count. We cannot be patient. We must give our best every day and not be satisfied the next day with yesterday's best. It's got to keep getting better and better and better to measure up.
Yeah.
You know, it's really such an honor and privilege to be able to talk with individuals like you and to be able to reach your listening audience, because this is so much bigger than the military. It takes a nation to embrace and heal its warriors and bring them all the way home.
Brigadier General Laurie Sutton is the military's top-ranking psychiatrist and the director of the Pentagon's Centers of Excellence for Psychological Health and Traumatic Brain Injury. Steve Paulson spoke with her. And Strange Champs interviewed Colby Bazell over 4 years ago, after Colby returned from his first tour of duty in Iraq. As a machine gunner in a striker brigade in Mosul, Colby saw a lot of heavy combat. He spoke in that interview about wanting to sort out what happened in Iraq, about getting it back together and taking advantage of the GI Bill for college. That was then. This is now. Diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and struggling with addiction, Colby Bazell's war continues. Anne sat down once again with Colby to talk about what it's like living with PTSD.
I don't know. I mean, at first, you think everything's normal, and then you just notice things that you're doing that you don't realize you're doing it at the time. Like, for me, it was just the big thing is I just locked myself in my room. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, in a small studio, month-to-month apartment, and my routine pretty much every day was to the liquor store and back. I would go back to my room and just drink. And that was pretty much what I did every night. I mean, a couple times I'd be like, hey, wait a minute, I haven't left my apartment really in about a week or two. And I would try to leave and go on a walk or go somewhere else or go to a restaurant. And I don't know, it's just this feeling of I just want to go back to my room. I just want to lock the door and just stay in my room.
Were you having extreme anxiety attacks if you left, or were you just so depressed you pretty much didn't want to do anything?
Both. If I was around other people, I'd want to get away from that. I'd want to just be by myself. Yeah, I just wanted to spend the majority of my time just absolutely by myself. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I didn't want to be around other people. I mean, there's little small things, like you'd be at a restaurant and you'd look around and you'd just be like, whoa, these people are totally oblivious that there's something going on right now in the Middle East, that there's like, you know, 150,000 troops over there right now, you know, going out on missions, doing this and that. And these people, you know, you come back and you see how everything's just, life goes on and everything's normal and like nothing is really going on. And it's like, you know, the war's like invisible to everyone.
Did you feel angry at those people in the restaurant? You know, that while you were out risking your life and nearly getting killed so many different times, they were just there eating in their restaurants?
Yeah, it took a long time to adjust to that. Yeah, I mean, even friends and family sometimes, you know, they're oblivious to it and they just sort of bottle it up inside of you, especially if, like, you know, you meet someone and they go, hey, you know, what have you been up to? Oh, I was in Iraq. I always feel like, you know, A, I'm immediately judged for that, or, you know, I have to justify my decisions for joining the military, going over there. You know, it's always followed up by, you know, why in the hell did you do that? Or how could you, you know, participate in something like that? And that would just automatically make me want to go back and lock myself in the room.
What did you do in the room?
Just drink and stare at the walls, pretty much, chain smoked. I mean, on my computer, I'd have old pictures of, you know, the pictures I took while I was over there, and, you know, the friends I made in the Army and, you know, my time there and videos. You know, sometimes I'd stare at that, and I tried not to because it just reminded me, but mostly it's just numbing myself to everything. Hmm. That's pretty much what I did for a while.
I want to play back a little of the interview we did 4 years ago. At that time, you were feeling kind of overwhelmed by everything you'd lived through, and I asked you how you were dealing with it. And you told me this story about a really hard day you had had in Iraq. You'd lived through an ambush, and something your sergeant said to you.
Right after the ambush, we went back to the base, and we were all loaded up and ready to go back out. And I wasn't really in the mood to going back out, especially since it was nighttime, and that's, like, really scary, because you really don't know what's going on, and then that's the confusion. And my friend Sergeant Vance saw me sitting by myself and came over and sat next to me, and, you know, me and him talked about what was going on. I told him my fears, and his dad was in Vietnam, and he said, you know, the advice he gave him for situations like this was to put all the events, you know, put everything that bothers you and clogs your head up at night and put it in a shoebox, put a lid on it, and deal with it later. You know, you've got a job to do, just deal with it later. And, you know, looking back, that's kind of what I did with the whole war. I mean, you know, and it's all kind of in a shoebox kind of for me.
So here it is 4 years later. I guess it's later. Have you opened the shoebox?
No, I mean, at times and stuff, but no, it's like how this other veteran told me once, you know, you just got to look at your time in the military and your experience over there as like just a chapter in your life that's over and move on. You know, that's what I've been trying to do.
Hmm. You know, there's been a fair amount of coverage in the press about the high percentage of returning vets with post-traumatic stress disorder. The statistics don't really convey what it's like on a daily basis to live with PTSD. What's your own experience been?
Well, everyone's different. I mean, for me, I mean, there's not a VA hospital in this country where I can't walk into and have them evaluate me and say, yeah, you've totally have PTSD. You know, they ask you a series of questions like your sleep pattern, how much you drink, how often do you think about the war? Was there anything happened to you over there that, you know, you felt like your life was in danger? Questions like that. You watch the movies and, you know, it's like the guy has flashbacks and he's unable to function. And just for me, it's just turning to substances so I can numb myself. I try not to talk to anyone about it. You know, now when somebody asks me what I've been up to or anything like that, I'd hardly ever tell anyone that I was in the military or was in the Army just because, you know, I don't like talking about it because no one will understand or get it or, you know, I'm scared of what questions they'll ask after I tell them. So just for me, it's just keeping everything inside and just, you know.
You've also written about a kind of ironic and sort of awful postscript to your tour of duty. You know, you were back trying to get your life together, and then the Army called and said it wanted you back. And first of all, I mean, given your level of dysfunctionality, that must have seemed just incredible to you. And also, you weren't expecting it. You'd sort of had the impression that you and the Army were done with each other. So what happened?
Well, I still get phone calls from the Army, like at least once a week, you know. It's kind of like a telemarketer doing pressure sales, trying to get you to reenlist and voluntarily go back into the Army. And now when they call, I just tell them, you know, yeah, I would really like to do that, except for, you know, I have no legs. You know, I lost my legs in Iraq. And then they'll say, look, I'm sorry, you know, and they'll quickly hang up. But, you know, they always try to pressure you into enlisting.
Well, you actually did at one point. I mean, you wound up back at Fort Benning, right?
Well, I got a letter in the mail, you know, requesting my presence at Fort Benning. When you sign a military contract, there's this wording in the contract where it says that they can call you back at any time within 8 years. At that time, I was like, okay, I'm going to go back to school. I have this GI Bill. You know, it's my third time trying to go back to school. I mean, the GI Bill, and there's so much paperwork involved, and it's such a headache trying to get it started that usually I just give up. But like this time, I was like, okay, I'm definitely going to go back to school no matter what. I'm going to use my GI Bill. I'm going to straighten my life together. I'm gonna do this. And, you know, I signed up for the classes and was all set to go. And all of a sudden I get this letter in the mail saying that I have to go back to Iraq. Yeah, and then I went to the VA hospital, got evaluated, showed up to Fort Benning, handed him my, you know, medical evaluation. They were like, yeah, you can go home now, kind of thing. But that was it. It's weird. Like, you get out of the military and there's no, like, you know, from my experience, the only contact you get from them is to get you to reenlist or go over there. I mean, there's, you know, they don't really do anything other than that for returning veterans that I've seen.
How long were you in Iraq?
Too long. No, I was there for about a year.
Because it just strikes me that, maybe it strikes you this way too, that you've been at home messed up for longer than you were actually in Iraq.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you think the war's over once you land, you know, back home, but it's like what one time I was in Georgia at a bar outside of Fort Benning, and there was a guy that just came back from his second deployment, and he was getting wasted at the bar, and I sat down next to him and started talking to him. He said he just got back, and, you know, we're talking about our experiences being back, and he said something to me. You know, he's all drunk and his head was down on the bar, and, you know, he could barely talk, and he said something. He said, this is the worst part. And I kind of looked at him, and he's like, this is the worst part, coming home. You know, and he looks around the bar and he goes, no one here gets it. No one here will understand. And, You know, he's kind of right. You know, I never forgot that. You know, the worst part, you know, is kind of coming home.
Colby Bozell speaking with Ann Strangeshamps. He served in Iraq as a machine gunner for a Striker Brigade combat team. A collection of Colby Bozell's Iraq War blog entries can be found in his book called My War.
They found a way to kill me yet. Eyes burn with stinging sweat. Seems every
best of our knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called Coming Home. It's part of our special series, Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio. This series was produced by Charles Monroe Kane, with the help of Veronica Rickert, Ann Strangeshamps, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Claire Radomski, and Madeline Mayon. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. Original theme music for Boots on the Ground, Stories from the War in Iraq, was written by Steve Mullen at Walk West Productions. For more information on this series, please go to our website at ttbook.org/bootsontheground.
PRI, Public Radio International.